Welcome to the March 29th, 2017 meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. We have a number of work sessions and witnesses who are here today, and so we're going to get started.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I know we've got a busy agenda, but I'm looking out in the audience. I think we have some guests here today from Lake Oswego that you may know.
Well, thank you, Representative Gomberg. We sure do. Today, it being spring vacation, we have here a couple of young people from Lake Oswego, my daughter, Julia, and Doris Yang and Amy Wong, who are all part of our student leadership cabinet for the House District. And I see another young person here. Perhaps Mr. Hayes, is there someone here who's a special guest of yours? Or no?
Oh, my.
Look at how wonderfully young you are.
You've
done a better job of staying out of the sun than we have. Any other special guests here who are here in honor of spring break? No. All right. Well, welcome. And with that, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2150 and ask Mr. Crawford to describe the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2150 requires the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to allow manufacturers or distributors of wine, ciders, or malt beverages to electronically file both a statement of the quantity of wine, cider, or malt beverages produced, purchased, or received, and pay privilege taxes on such activities starting January 1st, 2018. Becomes effective on the 91st day after sine die.
So to refresh people's recollection, this bill is one of a suite of bills that we have that would reduce sort of regulatory burden and streamline operations to make it easier for businesses that operate in the beverage sector, the adult beverage sector, to operate with minimal transaction costs, expand their market share, and do business. And it came to us from the Committee on Small Business Growth, which was in action under the leadership of Representative Gomberg during the interim. And I would welcome a motion on the bill.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2150 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves House Bill 2150 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2150 and open a work session on House Bill 2900. Mr. Crawford, could you please do the honors?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2900 allows ports to advertise activities of the port and activities of others using port facilities.
So, again, this is a bill that we had a public hearing on earlier, and there were some kind of conversations between proponents and opponents over the last 2 weeks, and that's all been resolved without the addition of any language to the bill. And now we are ready to move forward with a motion on the bill.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2900 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I'm going to open a work session just to make sure that I did that. And could you please repeat that motion?
I'd be happy to. Thanks. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2900 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves House Bill 2900 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes, and we will have Representative Boone be the carrier for that bill. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2900. I am pleased to see that one of our legislative colleagues is here now for a public hearing and possible work session, which I will open. I think that's right. Opening a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2743. And Representative Huffman, if you could come forward, that would be great. And Mr. Crawford, could you please do the honors and introduce the bill for us?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2743 requires Land Conservation and Development Commission to establish a pilot program to implement a master plan for economic development on land adjacent to a rural airport. Requires commission to report on the pilot program to the legislative committees related to housing and human services during the 2022 session of the Legislative Assembly.
Welcome, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Huffman, State Rep for House District 59, which includes Madras and Jefferson County. Thanks so much for hearing our bill this morning. We truly believe that we have a unique situation in Madras around the airport and the overlay with the industrial land, and we've been working with DLCD on the process, recommending a pilot, but we do have a unique situation, as you will hear in testimony, and so what we are hoping to do is move forward in the most cost-effective, efficient manner for Madras and the airport so that we don't drag out a otherwise allowable process over a period of many years and hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I appreciate your attention to 2743 this morning, and thank you very much.
Very nice. Any questions for Representative Huffman? All right. Thank you so much for being here. We have a number of witnesses who are signed up to testify in support of this bill today, and a couple of them have driven over 100 miles. So thank you for coming to the meeting today. And I will call forward, please, Ann Ramalio, who will hopefully repeat that name with a correct pronunciation in a minute, and Gus Burrill from the City of Madras. Are those two in the room? Could you please come forward to the witness table? And we'll ask you to, and then after that we'll have Mayor M. Banks and Mr. Doug Riggs come forward. And Mr. Riggs, if you'd like to come forward now, that would be just fine. The process that we use is that you can begin in any order. And please start by stating your name for the record, and then go ahead and let us know what you'd like us to know. And, gentlemen, I'll let you decide what makes sense for starting order.
Okay. My name is Gus Burles. I'm the city administrator for the city of Madras. And over the last several years, we've been working with new development opportunities at the Madras Airport. We were in front of this committee 2 years ago asking your permission to serve sewer to the Daimler Trucks North America site. And in our support letter, I'm going to be referencing this exhibit here to you. It's our airport, and it's about 2,150 acres. Of that, we still have about 1,175 outside of it. But the process we've gone through with them is they evaluated sites all the way around our airport, inside and outside our urban growth boundary. The airport is currently split zones, so some of it's in the urban growth boundary, some of it's out. We own both. Both sides of it are an airport management, airport development zone property, so it is developable for industrial uses that are compatible with aviation. The Federal Aviation Administration, we do hold grant assurances to them. They do encourage us to develop the site and collect ground lease revenues to support the operations of the airport. So as we consider development of the property, it's consistent with federal assurances that we do to take care of the airport and make it available to the general public. So this process we went through with Daimler, we struggled through our regional large lot program to anticipate where could we move a couple hundred acres and make it available for them. And we literally had to wait for them to pick a site. When they did pick a site, we moved through the regional large lot program in Central Oregon. The largest lot designatable for us was up to 199 acres. The 200-plus acre sites were reserved for Redmond and Bend, according to our regional large lot. We did go through the process. We're the first in Central Oregon to complete the process for a regional large lot. That's a very good program for us because we don't plan to sell it. We plan to continue to lease it, and FAA doesn't want us to sell the things around our runways and airport. We do have an adopted airport master plan that's vetted with FAA, and this proposal before you today is consistent with that. Just want you to know that we have the Central Oregon Ag Research Center within this proposal area. They've sent in a letter of support and are asking, can we get sewer to them soon? North Unit Irrigation District has canals that go through the site and over the years has served farmers on site, and also our own North plant has served farmers on site. Those are interim uses inside the property. Long-term uses will be the highest, best use for the property to support the airport. But before you today, so that process we went through, Madras has expended about $50,000 to move about 195 acres around the Daimler Trucks North America site. When we thought about refreshing and doing it again, a lot of our local planning commissions were asking, why don't you just go around your area? And that is really why we come before you today, is asking, is there an avenue that you would grant us to do this one more time versus we figure 7 to 8 more times under the current rules? I do want to thank DLCD and Regional Solutions team for exploring all the current available opportunities for us. And one of them, DLCD said, why don't you, we could support you just annexing the whole site. We think that makes some sense. There's no rules against it. And we paused, we thought about that, and then we ran into our own annexation rules and our urban growth area management agreement with our county, and it prohibits that. And then we paused yet again as we're doing our transportation system plan update, and we can only show our infrastructure plans up to the urban growth boundary. So we prefer not to leave our urban growth boundary behind and annex it only. And so as we evaluated, tested, we kind of came back and said, this makes enough sense to ask for legislative aid, legislative help to, could we do this one time and not do the incremental approaches that for our community of just a little over 6,000, 50,000 a whack is just a lot of money. That would be equivalent to millions of dollars for the larger towns. And so that's the main summary of our request today. Mm-hmm. And we hopefully have shown our support through the letters of folks in and around Madras. And we have the mayor here today and then Doug Riggs. And I appreciate Representative Huffman being willing to sponsor this bill and thinks it made enough sense to bring before all of you.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, sir.
Madam Chair, thank you for this opportunity. I want to thank all the representatives here and Representative Huffman for hearing our case. This is one of our economic generators. The airport property is highly valuable for developing the economic growth of our city and the area. We have to be ready to turn on a dime because we get fed information from EDCO and others about businesses looking for sites. And with Daimler, they wanted something that was ready, and we had to work fast to make sure we were ready. If we don't have the ability to do this, it really limits our ability to react to businesses desiring something quick. And if not, they move on. We've got a lot of support from, as the letters indicate, a lot of support from the local community and businesses. Our county is supporting us on this as well. And we just ask you to, first I want to say to DLCD, I understand the impact it would have on them, and if there's any way we can assist, we would certainly be glad to. But
there's actually one way you can assist right now, and that is by stating your name for the record.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Roy Sendbanks.
Great.
Mayor of Madras.
Wonderful.
Okay, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Anyway, I'll shorten it up. Basically, we just ask for your help to develop this, and it would certainly be in addition to Madras.
That's wonderful. Thank you for being here, and thanks for that testimony. Mr. Riggs.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Doug Riggs. I'm here on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization. We are the organization that has been around since 1998 and represents all nine cities in Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson County, plus one in Maupin in Wasco County. So we represent the interests of all of Central Oregon. I want to note, if you look in OLIS, you'll see support from Jefferson County. You'll see support from the OSU Agricultural Extension Service, which does work with all the agricultural interests. You'll see support from North Unit Irrigation District, which provides water not only to our area for economic development purposes, but also for agricultural purposes. So there's broad-based support for this approach, and I really applaud the city for trying to get out and work with all of the interests, including DLCD, and we appreciate DLCD's support for going through the process. I will say that this is one of the options that DLCD suggested might be available. I'm not saying that DLCD supports this particular option, but it was one of the four options that they presented to us last year when we had these discussions, and we appreciate that. Just a quick reiteration. This is land that will be developed. It is inside an already identified industrial area at the airport. It is not intended for agricultural use over the long period of time. It's adjacent to water and sewer. It's adjacent to Highway 97. 7. So it is exactly the kind of property that we expect will be developed. There's no doubt in my mind, and there's no doubt in, I think, anyone's mind, including the department, that over a period of time, 6, 7, 8, 9 different applications, all of this property would be brought into the UGB for development purposes. So the question for the city, which is a small town facing economic challenges and a limited budget, is do we apply 7 or 8 times after we get a needs analysis every single time to try to bring it into the UGB, or can we do it in a more efficient way that still meets the goals and long-term objectives of economic development, land use planning, but does so in a more efficient fashion? So let me make 3 quick points, and then I'll try to wrap it up. First of all, I think it's important to note that this bill really isn't about Madras. Yes, we have the mayor of Madras here, we have the city manager of Madras here, and you heard from Representative Huffman, who's the state representative from Madras. But this bill really is about it's about Oregon. It's about economic development and jobs in Oregon. It helps all of Oregon, all of our workers, all of our schools. It's going to help our general fund and other citizens throughout the state. And that's the same thing that happens if economic development occurs in Portland or if it occurs in Coos Bay or any place else. We are one state with one tax base, and rising tide in any community floats all of Oregon's boats. Second, as we head into the next 3 or 4 sessions, I think it's important that we begin to try to think a little bit out of the box. And when an opportunity presents itself like this, I think we should take advantage of it. You know, the problem with the land use planning system from time to time is that you can only forecast what you know at that particular moment in time. So a government bureaucracy trying to predict a need is going to be accurate some of the time, but not all of the time. And trying to predict what industry or economic development generator might want to come to Central Oregon or any community in Oregon is often difficult. I think the Madras example with Daimler Chrysler really surprised a lot of people, and the amount of property that they needed surprised a lot of people. Third thing I'll say is that, you know, the land use system, and I've been here since 1999, I've done many land use bills and worked with many of you on land use bills. The land use process is about a process. I would like to think in this case that this land use process could be about a product. And the end product is an opportunity to have land available in a quicker fashion, in a more efficient fashion, to be able to meet the needs of economic development in Oregon. So last point I'll make real quickly is the bill is drafted as a pilot project. DLCD informs us that a pilot project would actually be more expensive than just simply telling a DLCD, this is a good approach, this is a good avenue, go do it. We would be, you know, certainly wide open to any suggestions for eliminating the, quote, pilot project on this. If the committee and the legislature believes that this makes sense, and we think it does, then certainly we're flexible on the mechanism to get it done. But we think that this, in summary, is a good bill. It's been well thought out, has broad support in the area, and I think it helps the state as a whole. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. So this deals with bringing land into development, and so, you know, my experience as a Clackamas County Commissioner during the Urban Rural Reserves process is that there are often a lot of people who have strong feelings about issues like that. So, committee, since we have some real experts in the community and technical experts through Mr. Riggs here before us, this would be a good time for us to probe questions related to this issue. I want to give other people a chance to speak first. Does anybody have any questions, Representative Helm?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions. The first is, you have the quorum of the Land Use Committee here today, as you well know. And we passed a bill that was mainly intended to benefit Madras in the 2015, 2016 session that allowed some extension of services. So catch us up on whether you took advantage of that.
Okay. Yes, I appreciate you recounting that as we continue to build. So that bill did enable us to serve sewer to Daimler Trucks North America. We've had a presence with them as being a part-time track for probably 30-plus years. They closed their Indiana track down, and they've moved it to Central Oregon. They're currently building it. So they pulled all building permits, completed all land use planning. At that time, went through the County Planning Commission, then came back to us for the long-term ground lease on the FAA-regulated property. And they are planning to ribbon cut May 18th.
And so that's phase one. They started construction on phase two, which was, the first phase was about 87 acres. The second phase was another 22 acres on what they called a vehicle dynamics area. And their phase three, they'll start focusing on after ribbon cutting for phase one. And that's to increase the speed and ability of the three-mile loop track that goes around our North Wastewater Treatment Plant. So I'm happy to report to you that you didn't do that for no gain, that your efforts have enabled development to occur. And this is the same company that's invested heavily in Portland to increase the size of their headquarters. I understand their CEO likes Oregon, and they're currently on focused expanding their operations in Oregon. Now they're partnered with a German board, but they have operations all over the world, and I understand that they're number one in a lot of their sectors for manufacturing. So I think it's a real success story. And we've had a hard time figuring out how much more land they need, when, and all that. And they usually give us a little bit of time to try to jump through hoops. But we're asking if we could be the land use authority over this property that we own. And that's that. I think it may be the summary of the request today. Can we have a jurisdictional transfer for land use authority on these properties?
Yeah. Good follow up.
Yes, please.
And so, would you? Under your own city code and your comp plan and zoning regulations, does that use fit within this aviation compatible?
Yeah. In fact, we couldn't even permit Daimler to move forward without FAA consent that it is compatible. And the big things for FAA are that Daimler has to agree to, they won't interrupt or make unsafe airport operations. So that might be smoke or bright, shiny things or any of those things they would have to mitigate. We additionally file very specific forms with even proposed elevation heights of building structures and uses to FAA, and they get time to comment and either agree it's compatible or not. And we go through that process with each development. In addition to Daimler, I don't want to make it all about Daimler, but we also have Aero Air and the Tillamook Air Museum that came over from Tillamook. They're affiliate companies, got some joint ownership. And Aero Air, frankly, needed a lot more space to park the MD-87s that are contracted out to the Forest Service for firefighting suppression, and they needed a lot of space to be able to do some testing and drops. And we've been able to, meet those needs for Oregon, as I look at Portland and Hillsboro-based companies. And so I just want to give you multiple examples.
Thanks. Yeah. Another question.
Thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair. The reason I'm asking this is that when we have situations where we're going to have what's going to become a large commercial industrial activity zone outside the city limits, associated with an airport, my worry is that the uses extend beyond airport-related, and that we end up having de facto industrial and commercial parks that would otherwise not be allowed. And so I see that you've attempted to constrain the uses here in the way that we've just talked about. But for the people that are listening and the committee, airports should not become de facto industrial zones that are far away from urban services and far away from transit and far away from freight. That doesn't, to me, as a practitioner in the land use system for 20-plus years, that doesn't meet the intent of our statewide plan. So long as the uses are complementary and compatible with the aviation uses that actually go on at the airport, I think we have a nexus. But if we move much beyond that, we're just skirting the land use system, and I'm not going to be supportive of that.
Madam Chair, Representative Helm, I'd like to respond, if I could, just quickly. That's an excellent point, and in Central Oregon, we've had experience with that in a number of our airports. I'll give you one example, the Redmond Airport a few years ago, if you recall. it's probably 10, 12 years ago, there used to be a little nine-hole golf course running around the airport property. And that was something that was run by the city of Redmond and was not compatible with the goals and the objectives and the guidelines of the FAA. And the city knew that, and so the city began planning 20, 25 years ago to move the golf course, which was no easy task. And they've now moved the golf course to south of the airport down by the Deschutes County Fairgrounds. So that's something that we're certainly very aware of. We believe that all of the industrial and economic development that we're envisioning around the airport will be compatible both with FAA regulations and state regulations. And that's why we think that this makes sense. I haven't talked to a single person who believes that any of what we're talking about will not be approved over a long period of time, piece by piece, section by section. So I think what we're trying to do is say, you know, there's an opportunity to here to do what we know will be done at some point, but in a quicker, more efficient manner that will save the city, at their estimate, at least $350,000. And I would assume that it would save the DLCD, you know, $20,000, $25,000 for every single time that they have to go through the process again. I will say that to this point, we haven't had people jumping up and down in opposition to this as well. And I think you can see from the testimony submitted that there's widespread support, not just in Madras, but throughout Central Oregon. And Central Oregon really does try to work together as a region. I know Representative Clem has helped us quite a bit in the past. But we really view ourselves as a region, tri-county area, quad-county area, you might say. But what helps Madras, helps Bend, helps Lapine. People live in one community, work in another community. People commute between the communities, and we're really trying to build kind of a sustainable tri-county area.
Thank you for that. And I, Representative Clem, who has a lot of land use expertise, has a question. I am hoping that when he asks his question or separately, you can let us know if you've talked to any of the groups that sometimes have concerns about pilot programs related to land use, and if they in fact are comfortable with the very narrow constraints that you've placed on that. That would be helpful information for me, and I know I can see that you've gone to great lengths to try to distinguish this from some sweeping end run around other land use goals. So I really appreciate that, and I think you're making a compelling case. But at some point, if you can let us know if anyone opposes it who happens to not be in the room, that'd be great. Representative Clem.
Thank you. I may make a comment and then ask a question. Do you, I want to make the comment first. I'm actually somewhat sympathetic to the idea that airports and cities aren't overly complimentary sometimes, because I have one and all the neighbors write me constantly every time there's any talk of an expansion because they don't want things flying right over their house. But that's where our airport is. So, you know, what are you going to do? So I get that when airports say farmers make good neighbors because they don't complain as much about the planes, that you like that. But the infrastructure part is then the problem. And you know, we dealt with this two sessions ago, maybe now, in Aurora. In particular, Aurora was interested in not using giant ponds that they were having to make, and they wanted to hook up to the Aurora infrastructure. But there was some farm in between that was going to cause a big problem if they eventually moved their UGB. They'd swallow up that one farm in the process. And I think we finally passed something so they could kind of leapfrog past that guy down the road and connect up. So I am sympathetic to that part. But because Aurora, as you probably know, is a massive hot spot for conspiracy theory around various developers who are using it to get in, if you would be open to adding to this little sideboarded baby east of the mountains, I think you will have a lot less potential conspiracy theory at what you're trying to do. I actually think that whole Miletus thing maybe has ended and they're growing marijuana there, if I understand right. But just in case, I would feel better if you put a little east of the mountain thing on here just so people don't think that's it. Then the other thing I was going to mention, I'm guessing it must have, my memory is just getting foggy. It must have failed, but at one time when we were doing the fast track UGB bill, Doug, in 2011 or 13, 2254, I think it was 2013, called 2254, so people could move their UGBs more easily and faster. We had another bill in there that was, I think, called 2253, and we either referred to it as big fish or rural fish. And it meant if you had someone really good coming and the property was right next to the UGB, we were going to allow you to go ahead and grab that piece of land rather than lose the fish. But it must have died. Otherwise, I'd assume you'd be using that, and maybe DLCD will know. But I thought it was a pretty good idea. I don't know what happened. Richard had a big group. Richard Whitman came up with it, and I think Peggy Lynch didn't like it. But everyone else seemed, yeah, okay, maybe if it's right next to the UGB, which is how you are, we could do something there. But that might be the other way to revisit if you run into trouble this way. I think you're wiser to go narrower and just have it be about airports. But I always thought there was some advantage in big fish / rural fish allowances in the land use law.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Madam Chair, Representative Clevin, we would have no problem saying east of the mountains. We did try writing into the bill a provision that says it has to be more than 100 miles away from a city of 300,000 people to try to keep the valley out of it.
Oh, 100 miles away. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the attempt to make sure that we were very narrow. But we would be certainly open to anything. I mean, we really do believe that this is unique. I mean, this is just because of the attributes. I mean, if you look at the map that Gus has shared with you on OLIS, I mean, it's pretty clear what, you know, the county had already set this land aside for specific purposes. What we are trying to do is say, yes, we as the city want to be able to implement those same purposes that the county had planned for the airport. Mm-hmm. It's just that we'd like to be able to master plan in a more efficient way to be able to predictability, save the city money. I mean, small towns are blessed with, you know, some excellent planners, and the city has an excellent planner, but they have one. So it's every time you have to do this again and again, it's costly.
Okay, that's great. Does the 100 miles from a 300,000 population city, the issue?
Yeah,
it sure seems to cover the area that you were referencing.
Exactly.
The line 14, at least 8% unemployment over the five-year period, that's going to narrow it down.
Yeah. Marion County's been less than that.
Well, great. Any other questions for the panel? All right. Thank you for being here. And I'm sorry. Have you had interactions with some of the groups that sometimes activate in concern about land use ideas? And are they neutral? Are they aware that this bill is pending?
I'll let Gus answer that, I'm sure.
So on our Jefferson County EDCO board, we have the chair of the Jefferson County Farm Bureau. And in conversations with her, we've had no concerns. Other members, Greg Williams, Deschutes Basins Farms, and Central Oregon Seeds, we've had no issues, very large farmers in our area. We've tried to reach out specifically to one of the Bureau members that was in opposition to the prior bill to serve sewer to Dima right next to our North Plant, and did not get return phone call. That was our chamber director that did that, Joe Krenowitz.
Okay.
But as I checked in with him, weren't getting a response back. I don't know what that means. Maybe sick, not available. I don't know.
Okay.
But made multiple attempts.
Okay. Thanks very much. I think Representative Marsh had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Just a minor question. Do any of you know why this bill requires the program to be reviewed by Housing and Human Services Committee in 2022? It seems like an odd match.
I don't. Madam Chair, Representative Marsh, I think that's a typo.
Okay.
Right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, oftentimes when pilot projects are created, there needs to be some sort of legislative review to determine the success or failure of the pilot project. If I had to guess, legislative council decided that since this has something to do with urban growth boundaries, that the human services and housing committees might be the best to review it if we didn't have a standing land use committee.
We did.
Yes, please.
I think more likely I was fairly clear that if you want UGB expanding bills, I'll kill them all. So the ones that they wanted went to the housing committee. But I've softened up a little bit on that. So.
Okay. Well, good. Well, I think this was really helpful. We're not going to work the bill today, but I am really interested in the bill, and we're going to close the public hearing on it. And we have time still to work it moving forward. It looks like that those are all of the witnesses we have lined up for today. Thanks. All right. With that, we are going to move into House Bill 2150 and open a public hearing and possible work session. I'm sorry, 3150.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3150 moves $2.1 million from the Administrative Services Economic Development Fund to the Oregon Business Development Department. Requires funds transferred to be used to issue grants or loans to the Port of Port Orford to support the redevelopment of the Port Orford cannery. Declares it an emergency, effective immediately.
Whoever sits on the end is going to have to run those two.
I'm going to like pick it apart, but it's pretty short, though.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sam Scaffell.
Welcome. Thank you, and thanks for starting by. You can please have a seat, and thanks for starting by stating your name. We look forward to hearing what you have to say. Representative Brocksmith, do you have, are you hoping to go first, or is it?
No, I'll close.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mr. Scaffo, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Okay, House Bill 3150, that's the 2.1. Do you have this up on your scopes, this PowerPoint, one that's up there? Okay. Just give you an overview of the dock. This is the Port of Port Orford. It's a couple things unique about it. One, it's right on the open ocean, so it's direct ocean access. That means there's no bar to cross. It means there's a lot more fishable days than if you have a river problem. Fishing grounds are real close, so that's good on time and fuel. So it makes it the number one live fish industry on the U.S. West Coast. It's also called a cannery. It's also called a dolly dock. If you see there, those two yellow vertical structures, they're the main cranes. Boats go in and out of the water off of a dolly. That's the name. Once they come back, they go around that breakwater. And I should mention, this is the way the dock looks today. It's been there since 1880, and it's done various functions. But in 1969, they built that, what's left of that breakwater, which is to the far left. And in about 1999, 2000, the high dock was built. Now the piece we're talking about is all the way over to the right and looks kind of like white and blue. It's a nice picture. It snowed there a few weeks ago. And that is what is called the cannery building, although it's not used for that anymore, but that's what the locals know it as, and we don't want to confuse anybody. Right now it's used for a live fish holding facility for NorCal Seafoods. They're experts at keeping fish live and getting them to market live, which fetches premium price. Next one there. Okay, this is what some more closer views of that cannery building looks like. You can see it's in terrible disrepair. The sheathing's coming off. It's got a lot of rot. It's got a lot of water intrusion. We have roof problems. It's structurally unsound. In fact, we can't even insure it with the insurance company, so it's just self-insured on us. It no doubt has to go one way or the other. Next. Just some things going on. You can see on the bottom picture is why they call it the cannery building. On the left side is, I think it's probably canning crab. These pictures are taken around 1949. Up top left is the top gun coming in. You can see that it's on the hook. And then we have the two fish buyers, representatives of our two fish buyers. That there is Scott in the middle with a big lingcod. And then Tony from, he's NorCal. The next guy's Tony with Hallmark. He's got a tub of black cod. But it's those fish like that lingcod who come over there live and other cods and trouts. I put a picture of the fish buyers in there because they're of key importance to the fishermen. Without them, then their product really has no way to market. So kind of a symbiotic relationship between them and the fishermen. Next. Okay, these are some pictures from inside that cannery building, fish holding facility. And there's about 8,000 square feet that's being used. This is, just shows a couple pieces of it. But it's really a pretty complex operation. It's not just a bunch of seawater dumped in a tank. There's a constant inflow of seawater. There's an exit system. The water is chilled. It's aerated. It's filtered. So they can keep fish alive in there pretty long and time out the markets and send them all different ways. Next. I just wanted to mention on that last slide, those black rounds. Just keep note of that. We'll talk about them in a bit. And the last type of tote, I know totes are boring, but they're the small white totes there, and that's what the product is generally shipped in because they fit inside 18-wheelers real nice. right. All right, so this is a conceptual design of the new cannery building. This was done by Crow Clay. And it's designed to be flexible, multi-use building. It's two-story. It's scalable, low maintenance. Those are the things we're aiming at for it. The bottom picture shows you the existing roof of the cannery building there. Now, just to give you an idea of what the footprint's going to be, this will be on or about that spot. If you go over to the right side, that's like a cutaway showing the bottom floor. And what we did on this building is we went all to black rounds because they have the best volume to size ratio, and they work best for NorCal. And instead of and we designed the building with forklifts in mind and an optimal layout. So we're going to be able to get NorCal three times more volume and only about 50% more space. So the bottom floor will be used for a combination of NorCal, OSU's looking for a research station there, Port Orford Sustainable Seafoods trying to expand its operation. They're local. And we have a company called Mach 1 who does sea urchins, and he's growing kelp now, too. Tastes like bacon, is what they tell me. The top floor will be the port office, a restaurant. There's one on the dock now. The golf course, Pacific Gales, wants at least 1,000 square feet of office space in it. So most of the top floor is already accounted for. Each floor is about 10,000 square feet. And then the rest will be whatever retail we can find, which doesn't seem to be too hard around there. There'll be bathrooms, there'll be an elevator, obviously. Next. And these are just some other businesses. There's Griff's Restaurant, and just I put that little cabin there. It's just 200 square feet, but it's been used for a shell shack, a t-shirt shop, a real estate office, a tax preparer. Mm. Right now it's a kayak, South Coast Tours kayak operation. So there's a lot of, there's a shortage for small, easily rentable spaces in Port Orford. And that silly little building is an example of that. Next. Go back. Let me say one more thing about this. If you add up all the businesses at the port, it counts for roughly a third of the local economy. That's been shown strategic business plan after each over time. It employs about 150 people directly and indirectly. That's from fishermen through fish buyers through staff and dock hands. The new facility is anticipated to provide 19 new jobs, save the old ones, 19 more. One estimate's as high as 35. I think the only difference is one estimate was using median family income to figure out how to divide that number, and one was using average personal income. It must be because that's how it works. I mean, that's how those numbers line up. All right, next. Now, here's the just some numbers on the only page in the whole PowerPoint with numbers on it. But I did provide some background information for the record with more detailed blow-ups. But in any case, it's estimated at $7.5 million. That's from Crow Clay, the people that developed the concept. EDA has given a strong verbal that they would back $3 million of it with a 50-50 match. So we don't want to leave that their $3 million on the table. The state has already provided $400,000 a few years back. The bill here is 2.1. That'll still require us to come up with $500,000 plus another $150,000 or $1.5 million if we get all the way up to the 7.5. But we've had strong. We've already had EDA, Wild Rivers Coast, and Ford Family Foundation, roger up some money, and we have strong interest there. And then obviously the Port of Port Orford will pick up whatever remains.
Okay. Great. Is EDA the federal agency or the local economic development agency?
Federal.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. If you could go back a couple of slides to the one that shows the footprint of the building and the this one here. And I'm looking at the slide on the right. Help me remember, is this parking lot connected to the state wayside and park there, or is this a half a mile further north?
Well, everything below the vegetation line. Okay, this is down the hill. This is downhill just as you're entering the throat of the.
He's thinking of Battle Rock.
I was asking about the Battle Rock wayside.
This is on the other side of Fort Point from Battle Rock. It couldn't even be seen from Battle Rock.
All right. Thank you. That was my question. Mm-hmm.
The port itself is.
Introduce yourself for the record.
I apologize, Chair Leininger. Representative David Brock-Smith, House District 1, Charleston to Brookings Harbor, over to West Cave Junction and up to West Roseburg. The port itself is, of course, would be down from that photo and the docks and so forth. This, above this photo, is the Castaway by the Sea Motel. And when you see that big ocean view painted in the road as you are turning, that's where.
All right. Here, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Scaffold, were you done with your presentation? I didn't mean to cut you off. I just wanted to clarify.
Good questions.
Excellent. Okay, how about if we ask Mr. Courtier, is that correct?
Courtier.
To go ahead with the presentation that you have, and then it sounds like Representative Brock-Smith will be the third speaker.
Madam Chair, Representatives, just to shadow what President Scaffo said, we are just here to ask for funding to make that match so we can get the ball rolling on this. As you know, Port Orford is an extremely economically deprived area, and this new facility, if it comes to fruition, would be a huge economic driver for the community. We have had nothing but positive support for this project. In fact, everyone keeps asking, when's it going to happen, you know? And obviously, we got to go through all the lines to make it go. But there's been extreme interest as far as new businesses wanting to come to the port. As you can see, the visual aesthetics of it is absolutely amazing, and as well as old businesses that would like to move down into the port area. It's going to be a huge economic driver for the area, and it's not going to be just retail. We've got industry, retail, and research. OSU has expressed lots of concern for opening a research station down there in the port as well. So it's going to be quite a combination of all three aspects with this new project once we get it going.
Great. Thank you. Representative Brock-Smith, it looks like we're ready for your remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're done with the PowerPoint if we want to bring it up there. Of course, it is a gorgeous picture. It's not every day that you see snow on the beach.
It is a beautiful picture.
Was that taken just about a month ago or 2 months ago?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Committee, David Brock-Smith, House District 1. I am a third-generation resident of Port Orford I grew up on the Elk River in Port Orford, fishing the Elk River in Port Orford. Been a business owner there with a third-generation restaurant that my grandfather built back in 1970. Used to go down to the dock and buy hundreds of pounds of black rockfish and redfish and fillet them down at the dock so that I could sell in the restaurant. I was the chamber president and director for the city of Port Orford in North Curry County for 8 years, and have attempted to, in every way possible, move forward economic development and tourism promotion and all of the above for the city of Port Orford and North Curry County. I've been a member of one of the five Marine Reserves that is located in Port Orford's community team. Port Orford had the first Marine Reserve in Oregon, and it's Redfish Rocks. We were proactive in those efforts in designating the Redfish Rocks versus having it top-down. We did it bottom-up and grassroots, and a grassroots effort. We have the what's called the Orford Reef, Port Orford Reef, off the coast there. You can't see it in the... Well, maybe. No, you can't see it in the photo. But it is, you know, world-renowned biologists have said that it's the third best natural reef in the world, which is part of this fishery. It has fish that grow faster, larger, and reproduce more often. And we don't know if it's the upwelling. We don't know all the factors that are involved. But what we do know is it has really energized a lot of the research that is being done. We have what's called the Fish Tracker Program that is being done by another Port Commissioner, Tom Calvinese, who's an OSU doctorate program, which is actually putting radio arrays within the Marine Reserve and tagging fish so that they we can observe the habits of about six species of fish. They mentioned the field station. There is a OSU has built a field station there, and they're looking to have in Port Orford, just above actually this dock, and they're looking to lease space here so that they can do some live fishery experiments as well. And as it was mentioned, they're growing the bacon, quote unquote, seaweed there, which in experiments has shown to reduce, if fed to bovine, reduce the amount of methane produced. So there's lots of exciting things happening, right? The Port of Port Orford is the only is one of the only live fisheries in Oregon, and it is also one of the only two dolly docks in the U.S. And there's only six in the world. Port Orford itself is the oldest city on the Oregon coast and the farthest westernly incorporated city in the United States. We have a lot of proud history. What we're not proud of is the fact that due to a number of factors that we don't need to, you know, dive into, we have the eighth most impoverished school district in the nation. 35% roughly of Port Orford's economy, as it was said before, is based on these on the Port of Port Orford. And these dollars are new dollars that come into the community rather than the recycled dollars. If you add the multiplier effect to those dollars, it's an enormous economic benefit to our community. We have a sustainable fishery in the Port of Port Orford, and businesses that are using it. In fact, there's a local Pacific Sushi. It's a new restaurant down in Brookings, an hour away, that utilizes the fish from the Port of Port Orford because they want to utilize a sustainable fishery. This project is supported by Curry County, the City of Port Orford, the Port Orford North Curry County Chamber of Commerce, and anyone and everyone that could possibly hear this presentation, and hopefully yourselves. Colleagues, we talk about helping rural Oregon, and this project is helping rural Oregon. So.
Excellent. So do we have any questions for the panel? Yes, go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick one. I have to ask the obvious. In my district, St. Paul, which is as rural as you can get, but it's only 8 miles or so up the road, has one dry well and one that's sucking up sand and the people, it's been documented, Willamette Week, Oregonian, everything, sludge, and we're drinking that in St. Paul. It's horrible. We need $153,000 to dig a new well. How can I tell the people of St. Paul, but Port Orford needs $2.1 million or $1.2 million? You see what I'm saying? It's really hard to sell, and I think there might be others that say that same thing. How do we go back to our district and say, yeah, but?
Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative.
Representative Post, I can tell you as a former city councilor in Port Orford, and I understand your comments and concerns. We have 638 water users in the city of Port Orford, and we lost our outfall due to the El Nino. We hadn't finished paying for it. And so we still owe, the citizens of the city still owe $400,000 on the old outfall, plus the bonds for the new outfall. I guess my point is when things like that happen, the community has come together to assist. We built a library, a brand new library in the city of Port Orford. The citizens supported the bonds that were never needed and never used. I completely feel your pain with regards to your citizens and the fact that they need this new well. I guess what I'm trying to say is we've already helped ourselves in those ways. And this project here is that heavy lift that we just need to be able to match the dollars that have already been, I won't say promised, but that have been obligated, if you will.
Okay. I would say also that I intend to work this bill. Thank you for coming up here, gentlemen. But even if we move this bill with a due pass recommendation out of this committee, it then moves to Ways and Means. And then they will do, so we essentially would be doing an endorsement of the merit of the project. And then they would, the Ways and Means Committee, which is the Spending Authorization Committee, would do an assessment of whether we have the money to support the project. So, but, you know, when you have good community projects that have an economic development angle, I mean, I would encourage the creative problem solving of this type, you know, to be brought to the committee. So I look forward to, you know, hopefully if we continue as a group together, it will be exciting to see proposals from a range of communities that we can assess the merits of and potentially endorse to Ways and Means, where it will be determined if there's money in the budget to provide the support. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome to go have a seat. Really appreciate your driving up or flying up.
Oh, pleasure.
That's great. All right, Representative Brock Smith. Since you have been testifying on this bill, we are going to give the honors of making the motion to our good colleague, Vice Chair Marsh.
Chair Leininger, I move House Bill 3150 to the floor with a due pass.
I'm sorry. You know what? I need to open a work session on House Bill 3150.
Chair Leininger, I move House Bill 3150 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Marsh moves House Bill 3150 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Madam Co-Chair? Madam Chair. Sorry.
With Representative Helm, and then you want Representative Gomberg to go first?
Yeah,
I'm seeing.
Yeah,
there you go.
Let's start
with Representative Gomberg.
I would like to hear
and then we'll go to Representative Helm.
Madam Chair, and I because I serve on a couple of Ways and Means committees, I'm used to saying co-chair, and I apologize for that. But the point that I wanted to make is I'm certainly going to give this bill a courtesy yes moving forward. But as a member of Ways and Means, I want to reserve the opportunity to review it in a larger context, particularly since I co-chair the subcommittee that it would be heading to. So it's a courtesy yes, but there's a larger picture ahead.
Absolutely. That makes sense. We've opened a work session, and we're hearing some comments. And Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I'm, like Representative Gomberg, I'm going to be giving this bill a courtesy yes. And here's my only hesitation is that there's a lot of the state that have, where the residents have decided not to tax themselves through their property tax rates. And that's causing ongoing economic harm to them. And a lot of times the rest of the state has to pick up the bill for that, and the people in my district are some of those folks. And so when I see asks like this that I want to support because there are economic multipliers there, I would feel much more comfortable rather than creating a grant program that we create revolving loan programs so mm-hmm. that we are doing the investment and having the investment pay back into the kitty so that we can roll that over to the next community that needs it. And so that's my only comment there, is that, you know, this says grants and loans.
Right.
I would prefer it to be a revolving loan fund.
That's a good comment. Representative Rocksmith has a reply.
Thank you, and thank you for that, Representative Helm. I do want to let you know that the Port of Port Orford was replaced. The dock was replaced from a post and pier dock to a concrete structure about 15 years ago. And we all voted for a bond to do that. The city of Port Orford, of course, has $237,000 property tax base, but we all voted for $1.91 a thousand for police protection. The folks here are, and of course, the port has a 76 cent a thousand, I believe, property tax. So I guess what I'm getting at is we in the city have taxed ourselves in order to pay for such infrastructure. The Port of Port Orford is very well run and is one of the solvent ports on the coast, considering the community around it is so economically depressed.
Thank you for that. I appreciate the information.
Okay, great. So we have, do we have the motion already made? All right, we have the motion, we have discussion. Is there any more discussion? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm probably going to vote no. Well, I'll give a courtesy yes because it's going to Ways and Means. But my issue with not just this bill but several other bills is we're $1.6 billion in the hole, and that's what Ways and Means is going to have to figure out. But I know if I bring my bill and you bring your bill and you bring your bill, we all have issues in all of our districts that could use $2.1 million. I mean, we could easily use that. But in that game, I know rural Oregon loses. So I'll give a courtesy yes, but let it be solved in Ways and Means.
Okay. I sure appreciate that perspective. Representative Rocksmith, would you like to respond?
I appreciate, of course, rural Oregon, Curry, and Port Orford is. And I appreciate sure. the courtesy yeses to Ways and Means to continue the discussion and, of course, the asks.
All right. Do you think we need to do a roll call or we go ahead with? All right. Are there any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries, and House Bill 3150 is going to move with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. With that, we'll close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3150, and we are going to now move into a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3031. And I'm going to go down and speak on that. Mr. Crawford, could you please get us started?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3031 allows a person to petition the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to allow a specific region be designated as an Oregon canicultural area starting January 1st, 2018. It specifies requirements and contents of the position and takes effect on the 91st day after signee died. The committee is being asked to consider a -1 amendment. The -1 amendment modifies petition requirements. It requires that the Rules Advisory Committee be convened no later than January 1st, 2018 to promulgate rules on this issue, and requires the commission be able to accept petitions no later than August 31st, 2018.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Colleagues, I'm State Representative Ann Leininger, representing House District 38, Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland, and I'm here today in support of this bill that would create a pathway for designation of canicultural areas. The idea behind this is that we might be able to help some of our producers in this legal business sector generate enhanced value for their products and begin to generate kind of a known niche market for their products by enabling businesses in local jurisdictions, communities, local jurisdictions, to petition for designation as a canicultural region, much like how in the wine industry, which is, of course, so much more established as a legal business sector over the ages and around the world, there are viticultural regions. Now, because of the legal distinction between the treatment of cannabis, legal cannabis, and the wine sector, we would be seeking designation through the Oregon Liquor Control Commission rather than, I believe, the wine sector has a sort of international set of standards that are adhered to. But in the legal cannabis arena, the creation of canicultural regions is actually an emerging business practice. For example, the state of California has been, producers and others in the state of California have been exploring the creation of sort of a mapped out canicultural region to help support the creation of known distinguishable characteristics between different regions and their production, and assist with essentially the marketing opportunities for these legal businesses. We have a number of people who are here today who have deeper expertise in this issue than I do, but I think when it comes to things that we might be able to support that don't involve a big outlay of money, but rather enable local businesses to grow their brand recognition and their vitality on their own, this might be an interesting opportunity. So I commend it to your consideration and would love to turn it over to others here to get further into the detail. Thanks.
Mr. Will Feetham? Peter Gendron? Thank you. And Professor John Burshaw.
So I think I'll take back over facilitation of the meeting. And you've been here before to the Capitol before as witnesses, but please begin in any order. Start by stating your name for the record, and we're glad to hear from you.
Thanks. My name is John Burshaw. I'm a professor at Portland State University in the geology department.
And you may go ahead and give your remarks, and then we'll move on to the next two.
Okay, fantastic. So I have a couple slides here that I'd like to share. And yeah, thank you, Representative Leininger, for that intro. I'm going to really just build off of what you were describing there, hopefully provide a little bit of context for what we're talking about here in terms of the canicultural regions. So I've entitled this cannabis terroir because terroir is really the term that's been used in the past in the wine industry and many other things. And again, I am a professor in the geology department at Portland State University. My research is primarily around soil and climate, okay, which is what terroir is really mixed into. Should I be advancing this myself or the computer? Okay. So right, terroir, this is really the right time to be doing this, partly because farmers in Southern Oregon and elsewhere want to know what makes their product unique. In this case, we're talking about cannabis, right? But we could be really talking about any agricultural product. The timing is right, as was mentioned, the legal environment is such that this is now possible, and I'd argue that we have the expertise, partly at Portland State, and the precedence in terms of other products that have been done previously, like wine, et cetera, for establishing these canicultural areas and or appellations. There's a lot of different words people have used to describe this. This is a picture of one of my collaborators, Scott Burns, who's also a professor at Portland State, and he's sampling wine here at the Geological Society of America meeting. Is part of terroir, right? We study this. This is actual research that's done. Okay, so what does terroir mean? It's really taste of the place, and it's a term that goes back a long time into France. It's been said that 80% of the quality and character of wine comes from the vineyard and only 20% from the winery itself. This is Dick Irath, who's here in the Willamette Valley. Again, terroir. So in other words, the area that you're growing, the physical characteristics of that area, and this includes things like the geology, the soil, the elevation, the water that's available, and the climate, this is really determining the quality of your product, okay? And terroir has been used extensively in wine, as was mentioned, coffee, hops, maple syrup, cheeses, and soon, I would argue, for cannabis. This is really an emerging thing, but something that we're looking to do. And again, just to establish sort of how this has been used, this is in France looking at different types of rocks and different varieties of grapes that are grown in these different substrates. Okay, so the rock type, the soil type is very important for determining what types of grapes you can grow and also the quality of the wine that comes from those grapes. In addition, the climate. The area that you're growing in, you know, different types of wines are grown in different areas. You know, you have on the right side of this image is showing hot areas, on the left side is cool areas. You can see all the different types of grapes that are grown. They like, you know, certain climate zones. And so the reason that I show this is because we would expect, so in Oregon we have established AVAs, right? American viticultural areas, and these apply to grapes. You can see there's a lot of different ones that are established, and these are ultimately based on the physical characteristics of the areas where these grapes are grown, okay? And part of petitioning the government to create these, you have to define what makes your area unique in terms of climate, in terms of soil types, etc. And what I've read in the House bill, at least, it has pretty much the same provision. You need to also understand what is making this area that you're growing unique, and so therefore a product that you would expect also to be unique. Okay, and these already exist for Southern Oregon. You can see we have a couple different AVAs down there, the Rogue Valley, Applegate Valley, etc. And it makes sense in my mind, at least, to use these as kind of a starting point in thinking about cannabis grown in these areas, what would make that cannabis then unique based on different soil types, etc. Okay, so moving into cannabis now, it's endemic to Asia, okay? In other words, this is where it sort of developed and evolved naturally. And this image here is showing this is a very large area, right? You have a lot of different climate zones here, a lot of different types of environments represented. And the different colors on this map are showing ancestral varieties of cannabis that are very unique, okay? And showing how these things have evolved on their own, right? And this is going to be the case with any plant that you deal with, right? It's going to evolve uniquely according to the environment that it's in, okay? Cannabis, no exception. And this has been studied. This is well established throughout Asia. You can see there's a couple different varieties here, and a lot of different researchers, botanists, etc., have defined different species and subspecies of cannabis based on, again, these different environments, unique environments that it's evolved in. And these just show a couple different examples throughout Asia. And I kind of like this image just in that it shows, you know, how did this plant spread and evolve and move around throughout Asia? Well, before humans got involved, even, you know, horses even played a key role in the dispersal of cannabis. They would eat it, and then, you know, the seeds would get spread through the horses roaming about, which is kind of interesting. So then we come to the Americas, right, where cannabis is not endemic. Okay, it was brought to the Americas with early explorers, European explorers, you know, it was used as hemp in ships, etc. And so cannabis didn't evolve in the Americas, yet it has started growing here for a lot of different reasons, for industrial reasons and now otherwise. And we have unique climates, unique soil types in the Americas, right? And so you'd expect that certain types are going to work better than others, depending on where you're at, etc. Okay, so this is kind of where I come into the picture and where I think I can support this effort here to establish these different areas. So the questions that I'm interested in, the research I'm doing that ultimately supports this, is trying to understand how does terroir, so specifically I'm talking about Oregon terroir here, Southern Oregon, these different valleys, Applegate Valley, etc., how does the terroir of these different areas affect the chemistry, the quality of the plants? You can separate that into outdoor and indoor. That's an interesting question in and of itself. But in terms of outdoor, you know, what are the optimum locations for cultivations? These are some of the questions I'm asking in my research. You can look at indoor as well. What are the optimal growing conditions? I have a current project that's looking at multiple farms, both indoor and outdoor, but primarily outdoor. I'm looking at diverse environments, so different sub-valleys throughout southern Oregon, from the Applegate Valley, the Illinois Valley, the Rogue Valley, et cetera, and taking a single strain, so clones, to minimize genetic diversity there, and growing these clones in these different valleys, and then looking at those plants as they're going to see how they're different, right? And this question really is, how is the terroir of these different valleys affecting the plant, the quality of the plant, the chemistry of the plant, et cetera. So we'll look at things like growth rates, et cetera. And this is really, in my mind, the way to establish the scientific basis for what makes the terroir of southern Oregon growing, indoor growing, et cetera, in Oregon unique. And I'll just sort of finish up with this last statement that, you know, coming from the research world, I very firmly believe that, yeah, published scientific research does benefit everybody. And in this case, farmers in southern Oregon, really, and they'll be talking about it in a moment here, but they have expressed to me in the meetings that I've had with folks down there that they're very interested in understanding the scientific basis for these different canicultural regions. And so,
thank you so much. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Leininger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peter Gendron. I'm from Sunny Valley in northern Josephine County, where we've lived for over two decades now. Although I support 3031, it is a bill that's been a long time coming for Oregon. I would like the committee to consider the following. I hope it's not too late in this process to put this project, where I believe it rightfully belongs, under the authority of the Department of Agriculture, not the OLCC. Although I agree that U.S. Geological Survey maps will be useful in establishing caniculture regions, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration maps may also inform our decision. This is in part because not all cannabis cultivation is built on native soils, and also because it is understood in the industry that cannabis quality is dependent on other environmental considerations. As an example, in California, in Humboldt County, that is designated a cannabis region, but that is a countywide designation. The broad use of counties' geographic boundaries does not address the different characteristics of the same strain grown in Humboldt County, for example, in three different subregions: ocean grown on the Pacific side of the Coast Range, mountain grown in the Coast Range, and the product from the Inland Valley section of Humboldt County are distinctly different. An example of that in our business is a strain that is called OG Kush. It's an ocean-grown Kush. That is a strain that had already been established inland, but didn't really demonstrate its true form until it was planted on the Pacific foothills of the Coast Range in California. At that point in time, that strain became unique and different, and as a result, has an added value as a product in this emerging market. Larger caniculture regions will naturally have smaller branded production zones within them, and within these will be held the brand identities of individual producers. This is something the participants in the industry are uniquely qualified to understand and establish. For this reason, I would recommend that the base maps and further delineations be decided by a private entity or a semi-public entity comprised primarily of cannabis professionals. The wine board is a good place to begin when deciding what this model would look like. We can take our cues from wineries, hops, and nursery associations in establishing our organizational structure, as well as the required certification and subsequent enforcement of these regions. I'd like to add to that a little further that the Oregonian recently did a survey highlighting the poorest zip codes in Oregon. I live in one of them. In fact, five of the six in the top section are all in Josephine County. These are areas where cannabis has already been pursued as an agricultural crop for years, and now with new licensing and regulation legitimization of the industry, we see the opportunity here for the enhanced value that goes with the branding from establishing these regions to help lift these areas out of the poverty they've been in for so long. Thank you for your time.
Thanks. Thanks so much. You always have great insights. I'd love to jump in and address a point you made before Mr. Feedham begins, and that is the decision to have OLCC, or the reference to OLCC in this, and I'll just let you know what the thinking was behind it. So, of course, having minimal fiscal impact is important in this budget cycle when we're $1.6 billion at a shortfall, and because OLCC already has quite a, you know, they have FTE who are doing, staffers who are doing work in the cannabis space, they might be able to do this work without having to hire additional staff, which is a strength for the ability to pass a bill. And then the second part was, since they handle labeling and the issue of being designated as a canicultural region that could be articulated on a label would fall within their scope in that regard, there was a nexus. But I definitely appreciate what you're saying, and it's possible we could direct them to consult with ODA. You know, in the future, it could be that all this work migrates eventually over to ODA, and I think a lot of good people consider that. I think for now, in the near term, it's certainly going to be with OLCC, but those are the thinkings behind it, since they have labeling authority and they have existing staff on it, without excluding the notion that they should be working together with ODA on important issues like this. It seemed like that might make sense, but I sure appreciate your insights on that.
Thank you very much, Chair Leininger, and hopefully as this passes out of committee, we're able to deal with that detail work in the amendments process and get this ironed out to the satisfaction of the industry and for the needs of the state as well.
Good. The posture would be probably, if we were seeking to have an amendment that we know of right now, we could try to get an amendment before we considered working the bill in this committee, so we can touch base after this on that issue if you have a specific request for an amendment that it seems like would make sense. So thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Feedham, welcome.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, my name is Will Feetham. I live in Jackson County, and I'm the vice president of the Oregon Sun Growers Guild. We represent outdoor cannabis producers throughout Oregon. I'd like to thank you all for the opportunity to speak today in support of 3031, and I'd like to particularly thank you, Chair Leininger, for pursuing this concept and bringing a bill. It's our belief that Oregon has a unique heritage of cannabis cultivation that will prove to be a huge boon as we go into the future for Oregon. This bill is a wonderful first step in ensuring we protect the Oregon brand, and it helps to further normalize cannabis as an agricultural commodity. As Professor Bershaw said, there's ongoing work to understand further how environmental factors work together to create the unique qualities that distinguish Oregon cannabis as some of the best in the world. As these factors become clear, we look forward to the possibility of eventually pursuing this concept further and applying for internationally recognized geographic indication status, which would allow this framework to sort of go forward and be recognized nationally and internationally, should such an eventuality eventually be possible. We're definitely, I feel like this bill sets the stage for us to protect our heritage and take fullest advantage of a crop that has the potential to be one of our biggest exports in the coming decade. And I'd like to thank you all for your leadership in this area.
Thanks so much. I think that you folks originated the idea, so I appreciate the credit, but right back at you. Thank you so much. Do we have questions for this panel of folks who are some very good thinkers on the issue? Representative Broxman.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to get my head wrapped around this, so I appreciate the testimony in the caniculture. I understand, you know, when we're, is it terroir? Thank you. I understand the terroir, and especially when it comes to soil and climate for wine. My question is, I understand climate for the cannabis industry, but as far as the soil, so many folks use blended soils. The marijuana plants are replanted every year. A lot of them are raised.
that soil is new soil. And so I'm confused on how we tie that in, considering the soil that could be being utilized in Josephine County could be coming from Columbia County.
Please go ahead.
If I may, Madam
yes.
Chair, thank you, Representative Smith, members of the committee. That is a distinct delineation that is unique to this industry. You might do well with a Malbec in southern Douglas County, where the results would not be as desirable in the northern Willamette Valley due to soil conditions specifically. The reason that I bring up NOAA maps is in Josephine County, where I live in Sunny Valley, we have a unique set of climatic conditions that cause the cultivars that I develop to be different than they would be if they were grown either 5 miles north in Wolf Creek, where it's raining, or 5 miles south in Hugo, where it's socked in with fog until 3 p.m. Sunny Valley is truly unique in its dynamic. We have a wonderful geothermal updraft that comes in from the western end of the valley and clears everything out. So in that sense, the climate is actually more important than the soil for that particular subregion of Josephine County.
Mr. Feetham, go ahead, and then I'm going to make a comment about rulemaking.
Okay, and I have something. We don't yet have the level of research that we could use to accurately answer that question or to address that issue. I think that this bill is a good effort to get us moving in that path, and it's possible that some of the cultivation techniques that are currently being used will become less popular or less used if it's demonstrated clearly that there are unique characteristics to, you know, using native soil. And so I think not only will this bill help protect our agricultural heritage, it'll also move us in the right direction of having the scientific information to actually make those choices at the farmer level. So.
Great. And I'm going to make a quick comment, and then we'll go to a follow-up question from Representative Brock Smith. My understanding is that the bill is drafted envisions that there'd be a rulemaking process, and in that process there could be some determinations made about whether in order to qualify for designation, whether product had to be grown in the soil of the area, whether it has to be outdoor or not. Or, you know, there could be some delineation made so that we're avoiding a situation where if you have a house that you grow cannabis in, you know, that you get to claim the same level of terroir as someone who's using the outdoor soil and raising the plant in that context. But that, I envision, could be something that's addressed through the rulemaking that's contemplated in the bill. But please go ahead. And then after that, we have three more panelists, so we'll probably thank you for being here. We're not going to work the bill today. This is an intro conversation, so thank you. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate those comments. Again, a great concept. I'm supportive of the concept. I'm glad to hear about the rulemaking, because I can see, as you had mentioned, the microclimates that are all along these growing regions that could benefit or hinder, of course, growth and the ability to have various terroirs.
Got it. If I may, Madam
yes,
Chair,
please.
Although this is not addressed directly in the bill, I do believe it should be contemplated in the process. I'm not only the president of the Oregon Sun Grown Growers Guild, I'm also a founding member of the Industrial Hemp Farmers Association. And we do see that within the hemp industry and the hemp community, they will seek a path similar to this in the future. And we should be mindful of that, because these plants are close cousins. Everybody knows they can cross-pollinate. But one of the things that tends to get lost in discussion is the potential economic benefit of hemp and its huge impact, especially in eastern Oregon. Just as cotton is branded, we believe that they will want to brand their fiber products, and they will be looking to this as a model to develop.
Great. Okay. It looks like we have one more thought from Rep. Brocksmith.
So you mentioned hemp. We just, and Representative Clem just left, but he's the chair of Ag and Natural Resources, and we heard a bill, two bills regarding hemp yesterday in Ag and Natural Resources. We're moving in that direction.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, great. Well, thank you all so much. Oh, Representative Lewis, please.
Madam Chair, just Just a question. I didn't see it addressed in the bill. Those areas of the state where voters have decided to prohibit marijuana grows in certain counties, what's the provision for making sure that those areas are not included in the petition, or has that been discussed?
If I may, Madam
Please,
Chair,
go ahead.
Representative Lewis, there is not a provision for excluding those areas from the potential of regional development. We do not know how the laws there will change in the future. I believe from the industry point of view, it would be better to go ahead, map out, and develop the branding for the entire state. And then if those regions choose to participate in the future, we won't have to go through this process again due to the way their laws are right now. Although they wouldn't get a direct benefit from this, when we're looking at the hemp side of the issue again, the areas that have primarily prevented cannabis cultivation for recreational use are the areas that are primary focus for development of the hemp industry. So although we don't have a plan to exclude them, we believe this could allow them to be included in the future as political situations change.
And I would say that there's no intention within this bill to propel or require any community that has said that they don't want to move forward with legal cannabis to do so. It's a totally distinct and separate set of possibilities, the designation. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot. And with that, we will invite forward Christine Nevidal, Caleb Hayes, and Ann Van Legasiel. All right. So we speaking. Not speaking. Okay. Caleb then, and we're also calling Christine Nevidal, who is a professor from California.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my understanding is Madam Nevidal has had some experience in the California caniculture regions.
Okay, great. So that'll be an interesting opportunity to hear from someone who's been working on this work in California. But first, Mr. Hayes, please go ahead. And if you could keep your remarks within about 3 minutes, that'd be great. We're going to try to get folks out of here at 9:45.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Chair Leininger and members of the committee. My name is Caleb Hayes. I'm here on behalf of Oregonians for Public Health and Safety. We are organic growers and labs from throughout the state, as well as a large collection of individuals who believe in clean cannabis, free of contaminants. The PAC's mission is to protect the public health of Oregonians by ensuring the safety of cannabis and cannabis products, with emphasis on policies that support rigorous analytical testing, validated science, and research that promotes the public health. We fundamentally believe that a rising tide lifts all boats, and that's exactly what this bill does. That's why we're here in support of House Bill 3031. Ultimately, our members have taken a look at this piece of legislation. We've analyzed it, and we've come to a few conclusions. We believe House Bill 3031 will bring higher values to cannabis crops in Oregon at the end of the day, which is good for everyone, as we mentioned, the rising tide lifting all boats. We believe this will decrease black market use if people understand where their cannabis is coming from and why it's important that it comes from that region. They're more likely to buy it and buy it off the shelf rather than on the black market. We believe this is also a rural economic development bill, something we strive to take care of in this building. Every session since I've been here, we've been doing everything we can to help economic development in rural areas, and we see this as a bill that does that. Lastly, because it decreases black market use, we believe this would increase tax revenues, which is ultimately good for education, good for jobs, good for a lot of things we care about in this building. So we believe ultimately it's a good bill that should pass. We support the direction the chair chooses to take with this bill to get it passed. We understand that there is a bit of a bottleneck at Ways and Means, and we respect as an organization what decisions you choose to make to help get this done, because we think it's so important for rural Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you noting the possible beneficial impact on preventing diversion of allowing legal businesses to market their legal product under a label that's authorized by OLCC, so, or by, you know, the government agency, should a designation get granted. So thanks for that insight. I hadn't thought about that.
Thank you, Chair Langer.
All right, you're welcome to stay there or have a seat, and we'll call Christine Nevidel. Thanks. Hi, Kristen. This is Ann Leininger with the Oregon House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. Are you Kristen Nevidel?
I am. This is Kristen Nevidel.
Wonderful. Hey, we've got you on speakerphone, and we're on a video feed, too, so we've got you in a pretty public setting. And we were hoping that you could provide your insights into House Bill 3031, which would enable the designation of canicultural regions in Oregon. I understand you may have some experience with respect to California or other professional experience that would be helpful.
Well, thank you. I am happy to participate today. So I did prepare some comments. So,
great.
If it's okay, I would love to just kind of jump in.
Yes, please. And we have 5 minutes, and then the committee is over. So hopefully that gives you time to say what you are envisioning you'd say.
Okay. Well, if I go on too long, please feel free to give me a warning to
okay.
pause, okay? And
thanks
I would
a lot.
Love to answer questions if you have any towards the end.
Okay, so, thanks.
With that being said, I would say good morning, Chair Leininger and members of the committee. My name is Kristen Nevidel, and I do live in Garberville, California, where I'm a longtime resident and sun-grown or outdoor medical cannabis farmer. I'm also one of the co-founders of the Emerald Growers Association, and I serve on the California Cannabis Industry Association's Board of Directors, where I chair their Agricultural Committee. I'm also a director of patient-focused certification, which is a project of Americans for Safe Access, and the founding chair of the newly formed International Cannabis Farmers Association. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today to offer my support for House Bill 3031, like you mentioned, regarding the development of canicultural regions for Oregon. I'd like to share with you also a bit of background regarding the development of cannabis-based abolitions of origin. So, as many of you may already know, cannabis production during Prohibition was often carried out by small sun-grown farmers utilizing traditional farming practices. And many of these farmers have developed and preserved cannabis varietals that have specific qualities when grown in native soils and influenced by the bioregions in which they are produced. These farmers have also adopted cultural methods in their farming, harvesting, drying, and curing practices that generally are sustainable, chemical-free, and environmentally sound and specific to their bioregions. And in many, many cases, these practices have been passed down from generation to generation and have kind of a historical complexity to them. Internationally, what we've seen happen is society really has moved towards regulating cannabis production as opposed to having it be a prohibition sort of framework or setting.
Hey, Ms. Neville, may I jump in? We don't have a lot of time left. We have about 2 or 3 minutes left, and I would be particularly interested to hear how things are moving forward in California with the canicultural regions there. Thanks.
Sure. So let me just jump forward to that. Absolutely. So in California, what we have seen happen is that in 2015, the state's legislature finally developed medical cannabis regulations known as the Medical Cannabis Regulation and Safety Act. And within that set of bills, it was three bills, language was developed that allowed the California Department of Agriculture to establish abolitions of origin for cannabis regions specifically. Beyond California, we've also seen in 2015 the Jamaican government apply for international recognition of their cannabis abolitions of origin. And then in 2016 in California, we saw the passage of the Adult Use of Marijuana Act. That act actually reinforced the need for the California Department of Agriculture to establish cannabis abolitions of origin. So, today what we have going on is, in California specifically, We're working with the Jamaican Licensing Authority through a group called the International Cannabis and Cannabinoid Institute, which is based in the Czech Republic, to create an international method for establishing what would essentially be internationally recognized cannabis appellations of origin. That project, through the International Cannabis and Cannabinoid Institute, also includes the involvement of the Department of Vegetable Growing and Floriculture and the Department of Viticulture and Enology at Mendel University, located in the Czech Republic, and the Department of Crop Sciences and Agroforestry, the Faculty of Tropical Agrosciences, which are all part of the University of Life Sciences in Prague.
That's interesting. Hey, I'm going to jump in one more time. Do you have that material in writing by chance, and could you submit it to us for the record via Adam Crawford? Because I think it sounds quite interesting and is stuff that I'd love to refer back to. We're reaching the end of our meeting time, so unfortunately committee members are having to head out to other commitments.
I do have the proposal that we're working on with the Jamaican Licensing Authority to look at how we gather the data that would show international recognition or provide for international recognition. So I am happy to forward that to you.
Do you have, is your State Department of Agriculture, I've seen a brochure that showed regions that were being identified for California cannabis appellation.
Yeah, I believe that those regions you're referring to were established via the Mendocino Appellation Project, which has looked at not just climate, elevation, and sort of kind of watershed regional indicators, but also the cultural components that kind of have grown up over periods of time.
Is that state designated, or is it sort of community recognized through this community association?
Currently, those regions have been developed via community groups.
Got it.
With the hope that the state will adopt them under the criteria of which they have been developed.
But it sounds like you are endorsing the notion that a state-recognized system, were it based on appropriate criteria, could have some benefit. And you're looking to align that with actually international systems, too. But it sounds like you like the idea of a state-recognized system.
Absolutely, okay. Because what I believe it's going to do is really protect the smallest of the producers, right? It's going to also, when you protect small producers by giving them a regional branding opportunity, it serves to keep them local.
Excellent.
Right? And the money that they generate, or the revenues that they generate, stay within that community and help to bolster the long-term economic stability.
Thank you so much, Ms. Neville. This is great. This is actually incredibly helpful, and I'm sorry for being abrupt and having to sign off, but this is really helpful, and anything that you are willing to share in writing with Mr. Crawford by way of follow-up would be wonderful, too. But I look forward to hopefully connecting back up with you in the future regarding next steps.
Absolutely, my pleasure. And if Mr. Crawford would be so kind as to email me, I would be happy to then respond with materials for the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Ms. Nevidal, very happy to do so. You shall be seeing an email from me before the end of the day.
Excellent.
Okay, fabulous. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, thanks. With that, I'm closing the public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 3031, and adjourning the meeting. Thanks, everyone. And adjourning the meeting.